This podcast is intended for investment professionals only.
Hello and welcome to this CIO market update from LGIM. I'm Max Julius, Head of Content, and I'm delighted to be joined by Sonia Loud, CIO, and Will Riley, Head of Solutions in London, and Jason Shoup, Head of Global Credit Strategy, LGIM America, who is joining us from Chicago. Welcome to the pod, everyone.
Hello, Max.
Hi, Max.
Hey, Max.
Well, this episode comes hot on the heels of our CIO spring update. So in addition to surveying key market trends, we'll also touch on some of the major themes that emerge in that document, which is bursting with insights from across LGIM's investment teams. So with no further ado, Sonia, let's start where we always do. What do investors need to know about the latest virus developments, the health of the global economy, and the state of financial markets today?
Thank you, Max. Indeed, there's a lot to talk about, but let's take it one by one as we usually do. Let's look at the vaccination and the virus developments first, because very clearly we've seen a big shift now from the virus focus towards vaccination. We know that the US and the UK in particular have been very successful with the rollout, but we are now seeing very, very good signs from Europe as well, who are very strongly catching up. But unfortunately, there is clearly the very dreadful pictures coming from India and some other emerging markets. There is now the worry about the Indian variant and how successful existing vaccines will be, or how effectively existing vaccines will be in treating this. So we're still optimistic, but we should not forget that it is not under control globally, and we still need to watch out how particularly the emerging markets can deal with the virus and how the vaccination rollout will go on there. Secondly, with regards to the economic picture, clearly all eyes on normalization, all eyes on easing restrictions and removing those lockdown measures. And clearly we have seen such a strong upgrade with regards to the economic forecast. And this is now underpinned by actual data coming through. So again, the base case of a very strong cyclical recovery is very firmly in place. Now, we had a very interesting data point coming in this week, and this was around inflation. Again, a topic we have spoken about in the past, and clearly we have made it clear that we have to assume that there will be a big base effect, because if we look and think back a year ago, clearly the decrease in prices is now followed by the opposite, i.e. reopening leads to massive base effects on the upside. And clearly the number we've been seeing this week, which was 4.2% month on month, which is quite an eye-popping number, and clearly has led to a lot of analysis, because now it comes down, what of this is transitory? What of this is permanent? And there were some very interesting highlights. My favorite is the used car prices up 10% month on month, which I think in and of itself has delivered 0.3 of the headline number. And I think we can firmly assume that this is a transitory effect. Likewise, obviously, hotel pricing, air travel, there is some areas where clearly they have been worst impacted by the pandemic. So we have to assume that there's a level of normalization coming through. Now, very clearly, the attention is on labor market in particular. So the stickier, more structural elements of inflation. And this is what clearly market participants will watch out for very, very carefully, because we will come to it in a second, and Jason in particular, with his view on what does it mean for bond markets, and you know, how relaxed can the market be that the Fed will sit tight, that we will look through, and that indeed it is mostly transitory effects that are driving the current inflationary backdrop, and that it is not more permanent. Right in that context, clearly, it's still the debate around additional fiscal stimulus. And we know that the US is currently debating additional measures on top of what already has been put in place. And clearly, that will play a big role in how the inflationary trajectory and the inflationary picture will develop going forward. Now, if you bring it all together and you think about what the market made of it, then we had one further element that has been very important, that's Q1 earnings season. And we have clearly gotten a good picture from companies on how they have been faring, not only throughout the pandemic, but clearly now throughout the first couple of months of the reopening. And it again supported the notion of cyclical recovery underway. And we have been seeing obviously cyclical companies in particular benefiting from this. So the market still is relatively well supported. We have seen equity obviously taking a little bit of a breather, particularly on the back of the inflationary data. But for the time being, we are sticking to our view that risk assets will continue to benefit as long as our narrative around the strong cyclical recovery is in place. And that is what is obviously turning out to be true. On the credit and fixed income side, it's probably a bit more interesting because clearly with that inflationary data point coming through, it's now really all eyes on how's the market position and how should we take this into context. And it was definitely a bit more of a muted response, particularly this week, but I know Jason will share more of his views on this in a minute.
Well, thank you very much for that overview, Sonia. And yes, let's turn to you now, Jason, and drill down into the theme of support from government. So please walk us through the fresh fiscal stimulus plans from the Biden administration and crucially their chances of being carried out.
Absolutely. And it really is going to be a fascinating few months here in the U.S. in terms of what's going to happen on the legislative front. So Biden has actually proposed two plans in the last few months, right? He's proposed the American Jobs Plan, which has a price tag of right about $2.2 trillion over the next 10 years. And equally large, he's also proposed the American Family Plan, which is likely to be somewhere in the $2 to $2.5 trillion over the next 10 years as well, right? Focused on childcare, paid family leave, education, maybe unemployment insurance, all of those things. The jobs plan is really the plan that's about infrastructure, right? But both plans are worth speaking about because they could end up being tied at the hip sort of legislatively, and we'll find out in the next few months. It's interesting, I guess, and a bit controversial that many of the programs envisioned within the jobs plan are not what you would typically think when you think about the word infrastructure. And if you look at the details, about half of the spending there is directed towards workforce development, research and development, affordable housing, caretaking programs for the elderly and the disabled, all of which sounds very good, but it's certainly not roads and bridges and even electric cars, right? It is much less physical infrastructure related. And therein, I guess, lies potentially the legislative difficulty, right? Republicans are opposed to doing anything that's not physical. And even though you've started to see, you know, talk about bipartisan solutions, the gap looks really wide between what Democrats want and what Republicans are willing to offer. Certainly increases the chance that the Biden administration will need to use a legislative technique like reconciliation to get this through through Congress, and that increases the need to be able to use your Democratic votes and where the margin is very thin in the Senate, and come up with a way to fund the plan that's actually more in a budget neutral framework. So that gives a lot of influence to the moderate Democrat senators, such as Senator Manchin, who's been getting a lot of headlines lately of West Virginia. He's suggested, for instance, that he's uncomfortable with raising the corporate tax rate as far as, you know, Biden would suggest to 28%. He's tried to draw the line at 25%. But it's not just Senator Manchin that we should be watching. There are a number of other sort of Democratic senators behind the scenes that are getting less attention, but could be equally problematic, right? So I focus on the senators from Arizona, both Sinema and Senator Kelly. The independent in Maine, Senator King, Senator Carper from Delaware, and also Senator Tester from Montana. And Tester is one to focus on, particularly given this last week. He agreed with his Republican governor in Montana in ending the enhanced unemployment insurance that's been delivered in Montana early, right? So in addition to getting normal unemployment insurance when you're unemployed in the U.S., part of the stimulus that we've provided is to give an additional $300 a week. So he wants to end that because he thinks it's discouraging workers from coming back to work, right? That's really interesting because it suggests that he's very sensitive to programs that might have an unhelpful side effect during a strong economic recovery. And so I think the next few months will be a lot of negotiation for sure, but it's also important to watch how strongly the US economy bounces back during that period of time, because this is not happening within a vacuum, right? And I would think, and we would think, that Biden's plan will not come in at the end of the day at $4 trillion. It will be scaled back significantly, but something probably does get done. And we're really in the sausage making kind of period, if you will, when it comes from the legislation.
Right. Okay. So what, ultimately, once the fiscal sausage has been made, and on the assumption that some form of, you know, greater stimulus package comes out the other end, and of course there are measures to pay for it as well, what's your view, Jason, on the likely impact on credit markets?
Right. So I think it's perfect segue. I think this is really about which companies are mostly harmed by those pay-fors. How do you end up funding this and doing it in a more or less budget neutral way? And maybe this is my background as a credit person coming through here, but we always focus on the downside and less of the upside, right? And so the biggest impact would no doubt come from raising the corporate tax rate and reversing it and moving it higher. There are actually a few sectors of the economy that benefit from, given their structure or the nature of the companies, from higher corporate taxes, if you can believe that. So some of those things are the MLPs and the real estate investment trusts, which are tax efficient vehicles. You raise taxes and you make the efficiency of those tax efficient vehicles all the more attractive, right? So you can see some benefit there. Same thing goes for utility companies in the US, right? Which actually are regulated in how much profit they can have. Higher tax rate allows them to actually take in more cash and provide some credit uplift, given that they have that increased amount of cash within the organization. A lot of negative, of course, for other companies, primarily those who have domestic revenue, right? Who have, you know, sourced revenue primarily in the US. The telecom sector is a classic example. They were a huge beneficiary of the Verizons, the AT&Ts, if you will, of when the tax rate was cut, it freed up a ton of cash flow and allowed them to repay debt. You would think that any reversal of that will be a slight negative. But I think Sonia hit on something that's really important as well here, right? Is that this is all coming in a year in which earnings are bouncing back incredibly, by an incredibly large amount, right? And the sort of numbers that we've seen in the first quarter have been so large that even a tax raise of the order of magnitude that we're talking about associated with these Biden, you know, stimulus plans or infrastructure plans may get lost in the shuffle. It's just not proportionally the same size. Of course, it's going to last a number of years down the line, but markets and where valuations are going in markets are likely to be more dominated by, frankly, the strength of the earnings recovery and sort of the blockbuster demand that we've seen from consumers. That's even more the case if you know, Senators Manchin and others have their way and the corporate tax rate doesn't go all the way back up to 28%. That's certainly, if it ended at 25%, that's a 4 percentage point increase. Keep in mind that President Trump lowered corporate taxes from 35%, right? So we're not talking about a full reversal by any means of the tax cuts that we saw with the previous administration. I guess in markets and what we've seen so far in credit markets, it's a really slight pricing in, right? If we kind of group all of the sectors that are winners and we group all of the sectors and issuers that are losers, it's really only amounted to 10 basis points, which is 1/10 of a percentage point in the spread over treasuries, right? So you have to squint pretty hard to see the difference right now. I guess going forward, you know, as the discussion turns to more, you know, from stimulus to how to pay for all of that stimulus, there's always a risk that the market psychology changes with that as we get to the sort of pay it back stage. And that's definitely something to be concerned with.
Thank you for talking through those dynamics, Jason. And changing tack slightly, let's turn to Will now. Will, I understand we've seen a marked interest in client appetite for cash flow driven investment in recent months. Firstly, what does this approach seek to achieve?
Thanks, Max. Yeah, cash flow driven investing, or CDI, is very much an evolution of risk management for, and especially focused on mature schemes when they're trying to look to lock down more risks as their funding ratio improves. It often is a good framework that schemes look to employ that they can leverage to help prepare for future buying transactions, as well as beginning to invest like an insurer. And they're largely focused on three areas. One being the ability to cash manage to actually pay pension liabilities. Your projected liabilities are only an estimate and do change. And so we need to be flexible in how we go about trying to manage those payments. And then there's also potential for, sponsor contributions changing, just given the environment that both, Jason and Sonia have been talking about. There's dividends from different asset classes, as well as real assets. And you all need to be considered in how you're busy pulling all those together in order to pay your pensions. And then it's more around, the actual cash investment to generate the returns. This is about ensuring you have an appropriate yield on your assets, and that your interest payments are contributing strongly to the cash needed to actually pay those future liabilities. One thing we have seen is an increased focus on ESG, and it's also about trying to refocus your credit portfolio on more appropriate assets, whilst ensuring that the scheme is still able to make those payments. You might even be thinking about, for example, having a preferred temperature alignment within the portfolio. But again, that's choosing the right assets, choosing the right cash flows, and making sure those cash flows are happening at the right times. You could also be thinking about collateral as well, and making it sweat harder, which is trying to find ways in which your collateral has actually been invested into high yielding assets at this, throughout the, throughout your cash flow period, and just making sure that you can manage that more appropriately. And then these all contribute in various ways to being able to, risk manage your overall portfolio in a better way.
Right. And in light of the market outlook and the themes we've been discussing now, how do you expect appetite for CDI to evolve, yeah, and the way that those strategies are actually managed too?
Yeah, we have seen it's a good question. We have seen a material increase in the appetite and the adoption of CDI strategies, as this uncertainty has led schemes wanting to better control those risks, and they've also wanted to try and see if they could take advantage of some of the gains made by equities within their portfolios. And I think if you just look locally, just to the UK DB pension industry, especially the more mature schemes, they are much more susceptible to severe market dislocations if they were to occur. And so, especially if your funding levels are, at or near, near sort of full funding, they can decline quickly if you have high levels of cash payments that need to meet liabilities. And repairing that deficit can often be much harder as the scheme starts to run out of time and has fewer assets in order to meet that. And so we have found that clients are wanting to try and take better control of their mandates, and not wanting to realize, often expensive and unnecessary mandates, in times of high volatility. And so having a CDI strategy where you can better manage those risks, and also have appropriate backstops just in case, of those emergencies.
That's really interesting. Thanks, Will. And I think it's fair to say that the severe market dislocation of last year is still very, very fresh in investors' minds. So, Sonia, returning to something you mentioned earlier, which is earnings season. So we're kind of nearing the end of company results. What have we learned so far?
We actually, I think, have learned that it's turning out to be as expected. I think we've discussed in previous episodes, right, the understanding of how equity markets have performed over the past year in particular, but even over the past couple of years. And there's clearly been such a narrow leadership, which was dominated by US, to some extent, you know, technology companies in general, but clearly given the size of the US tech sector, this was the dominant factor in global markets. And with that, obviously, this understanding of the growth versus value debate and the dramatic level of outperformance we have seen. As we have argued before, with the understanding of a cyclical recovery underway in the context of normalization, we had to assume that a broader growth environment would obviously allow that leadership to broaden out and that it would benefit in a much larger range of sectors. And with that, you will always see early cyclicals to benefit the most. So not surprisingly, earnings revisions for energy and materials has been by far the highest globally. And we're talking about 25% plus in terms of earnings revision for a sector, which clearly means for some companies, you will have seen even higher earnings revisions. And clearly that has been reflected in the performance of these sectors as well. Likewise, you will have seen those that benefit from higher yields, i.e. insurance companies, banks, financial services in general, benefit from this as well. And I think that is clearly the rotation that has been quite prominent ever since November of last year, and which has continued into 2021, and where we would assume that this broader leadership will continue for the rest of the year. Now, having said that, there clearly is now, or we will come to a point where there will be greater emphasis on more structural changes that have been, you know, put in place by the pandemic. And I'm referring particularly to those sectors like travel and leisure, hospitality, that obviously seen a dramatic impact from shutting down economies. But we clearly don't know yet exactly how demand will reappear and whether our personal consumption of these items will change. The example to me always is business travel, air travel. Am I going to Asia 3 times a year as I've done prior to the pandemic? And I think we know already the answer probably is no, and that we will end up having more a hybrid approach of engaging with clients in different regions via video conferencing, but clearly adding, you know, probably one trip per year to meet people in person. And that's a big shift because, you know, if I only look at me and I try to multiply this across the city of London and then we go to Chicago, this is a massive shift in the way how business travel might look like in the future, and hence a big impact on airlines and how they have to think about capacity, the way they price the seats and so on and so forth. And this, to me, is a theme that we probably will you know, look at in far more detail going forward, because I think there's a real case for relative winners versus losers. And we are coming back to strength of balance sheet prior to the pandemic and how companies have really managed the lockdown and the economic impact. And this will be something that clearly, you know, equities, as I've highlighted, we believe will be the preferred asset class in an early cyclical recovery environment. So far, this has turned out to be true, but I think there will be more opportunities arising from those structural shifts and themes that clearly for investors might provide real investment opportunity.
Jason, in light of the recovery that Sonia's just described, underscored by earnings season, and of course your remarks about stimulus, how concerned should policymakers and investors be about inflation given the recent data?
Yeah, I think one of the first things to think about and to acknowledge is that this is a recession and a recovery followed by a recovery that's been unlike any other we've seen in the last 80 years, right? 80 plus years. GDP, for instance, as we've seen in the first quarter and what we're expecting to see in the second quarter, is bouncing back at a speed which is simply, you know, not analogous to any other recession we've ever had. In fact, most recessions, you end up with some sort of scarring, you end up with a lost year of growth, right? We're not going to have that in the US at all, right? We're going to be back to the pre-pandemic pace of growth in no time here. Unemployment, even with the disappointing April jobs report, looks like we're getting people back to work about 4 times faster than we've seen in any other types of recessions, right? The savings rate went up in this last recession. It usually falls, right? So the Fed has exhibited a lot of comfort with the notion that the sort of macro forces that pushed down inflation in the last cycle, whether they be debt, demographics, globalization, technology, will continue to keep inflation contained going forward once we get past these sort of transitory frictions of reopening the economy. But I guess, and here's the point, no one really knows with certainty if that will be the case. And even Larry Summers, the great proponent of fiscal stimulus, infrastructure, and the Obama administration's chief economist who frankly reintroduced the whole idea of secular stagnation, is someone who's skeptical and worried right now. And I really like Larry's analogy he used in the FT about a month ago, which is that envision the damage from the pandemic as a bathtub, right? And in the US, we filled that tub with stimulus. And with stimulus equal to 25% of GDP, we've now filled the tub and we're flooding the bathroom, right, at the same time. And if even the sort of chief explainer of disinflation is worried potentially about it, I think we all have to also at least be worried about it, right? Even if it doesn't prove to be the case. So I think it's very possible that the Fed is right here. Inflation doesn't prove persistent. I really actually hope that is the case because it means a longer expansion to come. But if not, then I think something like a $2 to $3 trillion stimulus, jobs, family plan, whatever you want to put into there, whatever ends up getting passed, could add unwanted fuel to the fire coming later in the year, right? The other thing we've learned about inflation, I think, over the last 10 years is how much psychology matters, right? And if maybe that's the real risk. When consumers think inflation will be lower, it tends to be lower, right? And if we all start to believe that inflation is going to go up, we might end up just getting exactly what we expect to see, right? And so I think that also, I mean, economists speak about this in a much more precise way. They talk about de-anchoring of inflation expectations. But all of this transitory inflation certainly carries with it the possibility that we come to expect that prices are rising and we change what we expect to see as consumers and as such need to be worried. So no one can tell you not to worry about inflation right now, but no one can also tell you that it's going to be a problem in 6 months to a year either. And I think we're all sort of in the same boat, and it is the question of 2021.
Right, huge amount there for investors to consider over the coming months. Indeed. Well, Will, staying with the theme of inflation, we looked at CDI earlier, looking now briefly at liability-driven investing. How are we approaching inflation hedging, given the uncertainty over the outlook that Jason has just described?
Yes, thanks. I think it's... I think it's really challenging because as you saw this week, and as Sonia mentioned earlier, you know, the response in inflation markets to the, you know, US surprise inflation upside, you know, shows that this theme of whether it's transitory or something more persistent is something that is sort of front and center of people's minds. And as a result, we've seen global measures of inflation, you know, they're all up. UK inflation breakevens have moved up in sympathy as well. And they're trading almost 40 basis points higher year to date, you know, at around, you know, 337. And so if you look at those 30-year levels, they do look expensive, especially when you considering relative to reformed RPI, which will become CPIH from 2030, which means we have received several questions from clients and consultants around where the fair value of that hedging inflation is in the UK. But in our view, I think, you know, traded inflation measures, you know, have in the past and will, you know, stay high for sustained periods of time. And so to answer your question more directly around the inflation hedging, I think it does depend on your time period. If you've got the long time and you can weather the potential mark-to-market volatility that we're expecting to see, then I think hedging at a reduced pace may be the right approach. I think what we do find though is a lot of our clients are thinking more of a shorter term in being an end game solution, whether it's, you know, either thinking about buying or buyouts. And so, you know, in that near term, they, there is considerable uncertainty in terms of, you know, the path of the economic data, as we saw with that, you know, the massive miss in non-farm payrolls recently. And so delaying hedging may mean getting to the, you know, the end game more slowly or not at all if, you know, if markets do move against you. So I think, you know, we often find that the best risk management approach is to sort of review the relative size of where your long-term market risks are and then consider locking in some of that recent funding level increases by reducing some of your the scheme's inflation risk and hedging some of it away.
Thanks for that, Will. Sonia, we have covered a vast amount of ground today. What are the key takeaways for investors? And is there anything else you'd like to add?
Yeah, I think, as you say, it's really a very, very interesting period in markets and actually in the global economy. And to me, it is the way it feels like an inflection point and what this means from a client's point of view. And I think this was particularly clear in what Will has said. We have started the year, obviously, with global bond yields at a level where we knew that the profile and the characteristics that bonds would provide us with is not what it used to be. The return profile is different, the risk hedging capability is different, and definitely not what it used to be, and the diversification benefits are no longer there. And that's a formidable kind of problem statement that clients need to deal with. And you add to it all the other topics that we have discussed in some previous episodes, the idea of accelerating themes, ESG sustainability is the other one, where the regulator central banks are now stepping in. And if you add it all together, it's quite a formidable storm for investors to make sense of and to make sure that they can accommodate their own objectives that they try to achieve with their investments. And as Jason so clearly said, the topic around inflation and the understanding what the longer term trajectory is will be the key determinant for a lot of these questions that we've put out there. And this is clearly not necessarily only a 2021 problem, because I think it was very clear from our discussion today, the strength of the underlying economy is such that there will be a lot of positives, but it will be clearly the incoming data points that hopefully will give us a bit more clarity around the underlying inflationary trends, and not just the points around, you know, used car prices, but far more the labor market, wage inflation, and as Jason so correctly said, the inflation expectations, because that will be such a key driver for markets and how market participants will react, that then clearly I'm very much looking forward how the Fed will communicate around their path forward and how they will accommodate what clearly might be a longer overshoot of what we had originally anticipated. So navigating these markets clearly has not been made any easier, but hopefully we could provide some insights in what we're seeing and how we think we can take these topics forward. But I think we all have to be humble enough, again, as Jason has said so neatly, we are facing something that we have no real precedence for, and hence making sure we're bringing everybody within LGIM together to think through, to analyze, to bring the best investment ideas forward, I think is still the way to address this.
Well, that's absolutely right. And lots more for us to discuss on future calls as we watch these stories unfold. So finally, I'd just like to ask each of you what you've been watching, reading, or listening to pass the time in the admittedly waning lockdown before we finish up this month's call. I'll get the ball rolling. I've been listening to the audiobook of The Spy Who Came In From the Cold by John le Carré, which is a real classic, and I've loved every second of it. Sonia, would you like to go next?
That is very much a classic. I remember last time I said that the haircut was more important than going to the pub. I can now confess that I have been able to have a drink, and it was bloody cold, so it's not that I really enjoyed it, but going forward, I hope this will get better, because here in the UK, we can actually now sit indoors again, which is very exciting. And I've started reading a very, very interesting book from Margaret Heffernan on willful blindness in organizations, which I can highly recommend. And is a very fascinating read on how the human psyche is influencing our way of acting and interpreting data.
Great, thank you for that. Jason, would you like to go next?
Well, after that, I'm going to come as a disappointment. I suppose I should be doing something that, and reading something that's very erudite. But the honest answer is I'm watching old episodes of The Office, right? On currently the U.S., which seems to have a lot more seasons. But then I thought to myself, it's actually perfect preparation for the end of work from home, right?
That's absolutely right. And I'm a huge fan of it myself too. Will, what have you been consuming?
Mine's gonna be a lot more boring than the other two then, because I'm reading Bill Gates's climate change book, which I'm finding is just really insightful in the way in which he's putting it in terms of the different perspectives and how he's gone about it in that thinking. So I think that's been a good read for me.
Well, thank you for that too. And that's actually a great point on which to end this month's call. Thank you, Sonia, Will, and Jason for your time today. And thank you to you, our clients and listeners, for joining us. You can find the CIO Spring Update on our website, and our next edition of the CIO call will be held in June. In the meantime, you can find our latest updates via LGIM social media channels on the LGIM blog and, of course, here on LGIM Talks.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, you can leave us a rating, or maybe even a review if you're feeling particularly generous, on the Apple Podcast app. It really helps new listeners to find us, and we're always on the lookout for new ways we can improve. As a reminder, this podcast is intended for investment professionals only and shouldn't be shared with a non-professional audience. This podcast should not be taken as an invitation to deal in legal and general investments. Any views expressed during this recording belong to the individuals and are based on market conditions at the time of the recording and do not reflect the views of legal and general investment management. Forward-looking statements are, by their nature, subject to significant risks and uncertainties and are based on internal forecasts and assumptions and should not be relied upon. Where individual stocks are mentioned, these do not constitute a recommendation to buy or sell any security and are for illustrative purposes only. Legal and general investment management is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. For full terms and conditions, please visit our website. To find more great content, check us out on Twitter, LinkedIn, and our website, lgim.com.